So it's August. It's 1943. Over in Washington, D.C., there's a gathering of people, and they start to discuss this thing that will be called Operation Neptune. And eventually, you find out that there was a conversation between Winston Churchill and FDR. And if you go to the Churchill Museum, you can actually see it was a closet. And the phone only rang in one place, and that was on FDR's desk. And he had been calling FDR for 3 years saying, "We desperately need your help. Hitler is running over Europe, and we need help." In August of 1943, with Eisenhower in the room, they decided to put together what we now know as D-Day, the attack on Normandy. That would have happened Friday. There was 160,000 men. And this isn't to diminish the role of women, but it was all young men. And they were told before they got on those boats that there will be machine gun fire coming from above. The beaches down here from above, there would be bunkers, and they were just ripping through the beach. And more than half of those guys, 10,000 Americans, were to die. And that is where Americans have gone for years, just to sit there at that beach and realize the commitment that both FDR made. But can you imagine being a 19-year-old and having someone say to you, "You're going to get on a boat and you're going to jump into cold water, and then you're going to try to take a beach," and that would be, there would be five beaches up there, Omaha, Utah, there's some others. But that's what happened. And they were ripped down. They said, if you watch the Band of Brothers with Tom Hanks, they try to capture that. But in reading some of the accounts, that water was red with the blood of people that died. What we want to begin to think about is the scriptures, what talks about being of one mind or one accord. So if you have your scriptures, take a look at Philippians 2, I'm starting in verse 3. It says, "Do nothing from selfish or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each one of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but for the interests of others. Have this attitude among yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus." D-Day, if you track what happened in World War II, D-Day is when the war shifted. But it was at the cost of thousands of young men. And a friend of mine was just over there a month ago, and his name is Doug Pugh. When Doug went into Normandy as a city, he's 58 years old. When Doug went in there, people came up to him and said, "Are you an American?" And he said, "Yes." And they started to cry. He said, "We only have our homes because you came." I'm not sure America could do anything like that today, which is really sad to say. Take a look at Acts 2. I'm in verse 46. Acts 2, 46. "And day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple, breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and with sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all of the people. And the Lord was adding to their number day by day to those who were being saved. What I want to think with you today about is being of one mind together. This is not easy because we all come from different places. But it's really important that we, when we come to the important things, that we agree. For those of you that don't necessarily have a Friends or Quaker tradition, there's a number of things that are really interesting about the Quaker tradition. We're doing a membership class. That's my own PR for this class. If you've never joined, we're doing it Friday at 5:30 for an hour, or Sunday morning.
Thursday.
Like I said, that's what I said. Thursday. Or right before the service at about 9. Lee, what time were you here? 9 something.
We were here about 8:30.
Like I said, at 8:30. But if you want to join and hear more of the tradition of the Friends movement, you can come. But here's the three things they're known for. One, they give testimonies, which is part of what we heard of in this place. We gather and say, this is what God has done. And as a person who has, as I was saying earlier, I've had to teach the theistic proofs, and I can put you to sleep by about the third one. But I tell you, when you hear a testimony, my ears pick up. To hear what God has done is really powerful. So that's the first one. The second one is this phrase, can we all reason together? And that is something that America has lost. And people don't know how to discuss things when they disagree. And part of our work is to be civil to with one another when we disagree. That's part of our work as the Friends. Then the third one, and I was in a meeting like that Friday where I was pretty hot. You haven't seen that part of my personality, but I got pretty irritated with some people, and there was fireworks going off where I was. And then I had to back up and I say, I apologize if I am too animated about this, but I've got a lot of passion around people coming to Christ. And anything that gets in the way of that, you're going to hear from me. And the person said, okay, because I thought you were attacking me. And I said, no. But I'm all about trying to help people come in front of Jesus. At the end of that conversation, we had to have this phrase, because we're friends. Are all hearts clear? In other words, we can't leave if there's still animosity between us. Isn't that interesting? So for 400 years, when Quakers' friends have disagreed, the end of the discussion, when it's been hot, is to say all hearts clear. And if they're not, take off your coat. Put up your hat. We're going to continue to sit together until, here's the phrase, we can agree to disagree in a manner that's respectful of one another. Isn't that wonderful? Agree to disagree.
All right.
If you'll pass these along. So, next time you're in one of these kinds of heated discussions like I was, I want you to think of a
Q-tip.
And you might say to me, Bill? Only one of you are interested?
Well,
Bill. Oh, okay, so there's a few of you. A Q-tip, so here it is. Quit taking it personally. Quit taking it personally. Q-tip.
Oh.
And what you have in this is you don't allow someone else to provoke you. Now, I'm here to tell you that to be able to pull that off is supernatural.
That's right.
It's supernatural. Because our tendency is to light the firecracker and then throw it in whatever direction you're angry about. But the scriptures would say in 1 Corinthians 13, don't be provoked. I'm in the mall with Becky my wife. And I'm pretty heated about something. This was a while back. And lo and behold, who's in the mall? John Williams, the superintendent of the fence. And so he comes up to me and he sees me because he watched what happened. And he said, Bill, and he's got such this wonderful spirit. He puts his hand on me. And as soon as you do that, as soon as he would do that with me, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I know I'm wrong. He says, Bill, don't let yourself be provoked. You're letting yourself be provoked. And it's this idea, quit taking it personally. So one of the things that I need for you to begin to think about is when those kinds of things pop up, I need for you to hold up your Q-tip in your head. Go ahead, hold it up. Now, don't hide that in your pockets because you're going to be holding that up a couple times until I can get this into your head.
Yeah. Where's yours?
Right. Someone took mine. but let's continue and hear what else is going on. I promised you, I'm in a book called The Good and Beautiful Community by James Bryan Smith. He teaches out at Berklee College. A wonderful man. And he says there's a number of things that happen to us. We have, within our framework, the way we think, these false narratives. False narratives about God above, about Jesus, about the Father and the Spirit, but false narratives about the church. Here's one that, as a person who's done ministry most of their life, here's one I hear all the time. I can't go to church because I'm not perfect. How many of you have heard that besides me? If I show up, you know what's going to happen? That church won't be perfect. Well, that's the false narrative. You want to know the truth? The church is imperfect before you got there. So you don't have to worry about causing problems there. We are a collection of motley people with all kinds of problems. But we promise God above that we will learn to love one another. So now let's take a peek at some of those scriptures. Could someone run over to Ephesians 4, 1 through 6? Okay, Melinda, you have that. And could somebody else take on 1 Peter 2, 9? 1 Peter 2, 9. Okay, great.
As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worth of the calling you have received. But be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all.
Part of our work is to begin to understand where we can agree. Augustine, in the 4th century, and then Aquinas, and then John Charles Wesley, and Martin Luther, all had this phrase that they would use when they would talk about the church. Agree on the essentials. Freedom on the non-essentials, and love overall. That particular phrase comes to us out of the early church that goes back almost 1,700 years. The issue for a lot of believers is they don't know the difference between what's essential and what's non-essential. And the church has argued and split over those things for generations. Let's think about the church. The church isn't made of perfect people, it's imperfect people. And if you find yourself saying, well, I'm not perfect, I don't fit, just acknowledging that you aren't perfect means that you fit, if that makes any kind of sense. Listen to who we are. This comes to us from the scriptures. The church is made up of people who've had moral failures, people who've gossiped, people who look down on others, people who will say or act that if they don't act like me, I'm not going to be with them. ethnic, racial hypocrisy, political alignments, arguments over non-essential things. Let's hear from 1 Peter 2:9 and hear what he would tell us.
But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into this wonderful light.
You are a chosen people. So if you could turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor,
you,
go ahead, you can point your finger.
You.
You are chosen. Really remarkable to think about, isn't it? Not only are you chosen, but now let's take it a step further. You're forgiven. Now, with this idea that you're forgiven, and we've been forgiven much, a lot of us will hold on and say, even though God has forgiven me, I can't forgive them. And so I want you in your mind's eye, when you have some time and you're alone, to think of this justice, you know, the female that is the one with the scales, and you see yourself being forgiven. And all of a sudden, you know, you realize what a big deal that was. And then you look on the other side, and you look at the people you haven't forgiven. And are they balanced out? For most of us, we know we're forgiven, but we struggle. We're forgiven others. Part of that is because we're taking it personally. Quit taking it personally. Okay, so let's continue here. When you think of the scriptures and when you think of God above, there is a very real sense in which we worship a very peculiar God. What are some things in the scriptures that when you read them, you just go, you know, I wouldn't have done it that way? What are some things that pop up? Yeah?
It relates to squabbles between people in the church, but go to the person who's wronged you first before you go to their superior.
All right.
Or to others. Yep. Don't gossip about it.
The thing I love about where he's going is that Jesus came to us to forgive us before we ever went to him. Isn't God peculiar? Have you ever said, well, I'm not going to talk to them, and they come to me first? And then, I don't know if you're like me that way, and then all of a sudden, you know, God doesn't typically hit me over the head with a feather. It's more like a baseball bat. And I'm like, oh yeah, there is that. You know, and all of a sudden, you are cut to the quick. You have to wrestle with that. And I, as your pastor, I can't get you off the hook. As a matter of fact, if God's going to try to get your attention, I'm not going to get in the way. And if he's got a 2x4 to hit you on the head, I'm not going to stand between you and that 2x4. It's going to hit you. Because God's got to get our attention. Our God is peculiar. He talked to somebody out of a burning bush. Now, really, how does that happen? I don't know. He led people in a desert with a pillar of fire. How does that happen? I don't know. There was one prophet that was in a boat, jumped out of the boat, and God sent a taxi in the form of a whale. How does that happen? God is peculiar. Okay, so now here's the hook. If God is peculiar, you and I are going to be peculiar. That's just the way this is. Have you ever been in a line and somebody's wrestling with their money and they can't find their money? And you pay their bill. And they say, why did you do that? And you just shake your head. Because we're peculiar people. I remember when we lived in Colorado, we went to one person's house and I didn't know it at the time, but it was the family who owned Coors Beer. And we're sitting there, and Dad comes in, and the family, we were sitting there, I got to know their kids, and where have you been? He said, I just went to the prison in Western Colorado, and I forgave the man who killed my brother. And I brought him a Bible, and I said, you're forgiven. See, we're peculiar. Nobody else does that. Nobody. But we do. We forgive the unforgivable because we know what that's like. So one of the characteristics of the Friends movement is that they believed that the work of the Holy Spirit could be immediate and it could be discerning. Discerning in guidance on how to live our lives. That's part of the Friends movement. It's a really wonderful thing. But like I said last week, the Friends would not tell you how you needed to behave. So when William Penn had his sword, which was a sign of nobility, and he comes to George Fox and says, what should I do about my sword? George Fox says to him, wear it as long as you can, William. In other words, I'm not going to make that up for you. I'm not going to decide for you. So now let me take you down the path of what that means. For most Christians, we either err on the side of legalism, where we tell people what they have to do. And having grown up around people that I did, it would have been this line, don't smoke, dance, chew, and go with girls that do. And somehow you don't want to date a girl who's chewing tobacco. It's just not a good thing. But it's this sense of legalism. Be really careful when you tell other people what they have to do. But you can err on the other side. One is called legalism, the other side is called license. And it really doesn't matter. The evil one doesn't care which way you go or which way you err. License means you can do anything you want. You know that's not good. You don't say two or three, oh, you can do whatever you want. No, you don't. There's a sense in which you've got to be involved and help shape their lives. And as a church community, we don't want to err on either side, but we want to believe that the Holy Spirit can lead us to know what we need to do. And I would even ask today, if you are facing something with someone, you can ask me if you want, but I agree with Karen. The first person we need to be talking to is God above. Lord, what should I do with this? And then act on that inclination. About 125 AD, there is these non-believers that are having to wrestle with, if you track this down, you can find it. He would have been known as Christos, C-H-R-E-S-T-U-S. And what should we do with this Christos? And people are confused in Rome what to do with these followers of Christos. There was all kinds of false rumors about Christians. Some said they were dangerous, a secret society. I'm not sure that we keep that secret very well. It's probably good we don't. But listen, this would have been from Athagorius. Whew, that's a handle, isn't it? Can you imagine trying to spell that when you were in first grade? To a guy by the name Diognetus. Anyway, this is what he writes about what these Christians are like. He says, the difference between Christians and the rest of mankind is not a matter of nationality, language, or customs. Christians do not live in separate cities of their own. They don't speak any special dialect, nor do they practice any eccentric way of life. Although they might say that of me. They pass their lives in whatever township, Greek or foreign, each man's lot was determined and conformed to ordinary local usage in their clothing, diet, and other habits. Nevertheless, the organization of their community does exhibit some features that are remarkable. I wonder if that's true and is said of us. And even surprising. For instance, though they are residents at home in their own countries, they behave that they're more like transients. Though their destiny has placed them here in the flesh, they don't live after the flesh. Their days are passed on earth, but their citizenship is above in the heavens. They obey pre-described laws, but in their own private lives, they transcend those very laws. They show love to all men, and all men persecute them. I love this one line. It isn't in this quote, but I can find it if you want me to. It says, they love all, but they don't share their marriage bed. Isn't that interesting? In the second century. They show love to all men, and all men persecute them. They are misunderstood and condemned, and yet by suffering, they are quickened into life. They are poor, yet making many rich, lacking all things, yet having all things in abundance. They repay curses with blessings and abuse with courtesy for the good they do. They suffer stripes as evildoers. Isn't it interesting how even the early church, the pagans, knew that as a group of people, we're different. And part of it is that we are taking the lessons of the scriptures like that silly Q-tip, and we're saying we've got to learn how not to take and be provoked by others. And we need to figure out, because really what's happening, my friends, is when that happens to you, it says much more about them than it does about you. They're angry, and they're lashing out at someone, and it just happens to be you. Don't take it personally. Take that to Jesus and allow him to work through that with you. But if you wrestle with somebody, and in Becky's family, her one cousin would not talk to another one for almost 20 years. It's really sad. He says, well, he's so irritating. Well, that's who he is. We're still called to love them. So I need for you to say a couple things. Turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor,
neighbor.
We're still called to love them. Notice I didn't say like them. Notice I didn't say that.
Preach it.
So our work and your work is to step up, be filled with the Spirit, and start to do things that are supernatural. And one of them is, don't be provoked. And then cause that anger to reciprocate upon them. Instead, think, how can I love them for Jesus' sake? We're going to sing one last song.